The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025, focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's presentation is the panel discussion, Education Today, moderated by Indiana Commissioner for Higher Education Teresa Lovers, with Butler University President James Danko, Marion University President Dan Elsner, and University of Indianapolis President Rob Manuel.
As you know, Indiana is fortunate to be home to some of the nation's leading higher education institutions, both public and private. In previous seasons, the Economic Club has hosted leaders from some of the state's largest universities and colleges, including most recently the presidents of Indiana University, Purdue University, and Ivy Tech. I'm excited to have the opportunity today to introduce the first in what we intend to be an annual series for at least the next few seasons, featuring leaders from some of Indiana's other higher education institutions to hear a slightly different perspective. During today's inaugural panel discussion, moderated by Commissioner Teresa Lovers, we will hear from the leaders of three independent liberal arts institutions, Butler University, Marion University, and the University of Indianapolis. Joining us next season to continue the series will be the presidents of Ball State University, Franklin College, and Wabash College. So thank you to Teresa, Jim, Dan, and Rob for being with us today for this important discussion and for kicking off our brand new series. Before I turn things over to Teresa and the panelists, I have a few questions for Teresa to set the stage for our conversation about the value of higher education in the 21st century. So you've been with the Commission for Higher Ed for more than 8 years, and you've witnessed the changing landscape of higher ed. So can you tell us about the Commission's role and how your work impacts colleges and universities and the students that they serve?
A few comments about the Commission for Higher Education. We were actually created in state statute in 1971 as a coordinating board. Some of you may be familiar with other states where you have boards of regents where they actually run the colleges and universities. That is not the charge for the Commission. We coordinate a system of higher education. And basically, I think it would be safe to say that we have limited but growing statutory responsibilities. Among our actions that we take on a regular basis would be to make recommendations to the legislature of how to spend what is about $2 billion a year in funding for higher education. That we also approve degrees and programs at our public institutions. We have 7 very vibrant public systems, 30 very successful private institutions, and we actually have proprietary schools in the state. As you might imagine, we have different responsibilities depending on the sector. One of the things that's interesting to note that is in 2012, the work of the commission changed dramatically. Prior to that, we've been a policy agency, and we still continue to have that function for the state of Indiana. But at that point, the legislature decided to disband what was a separate commission that distributed financial aid called SASE and bring that responsibility under the Commission for Higher Education. You may or may not know that Indiana actually ranks first in the Midwest and fifth in the nation in need-based financial aid, distributing nearly $350 million a year in financial aid to Hoosier students. So that's good news, and that impacts our private institutions as well as our public institutions. I think it's also, as a part of our responsibility, we try to look at those issues that no one school could do on their own. An example of that would be transfer. So we are basically sitting in the middle of a lot of the work that's done with our partner colleges and universities, but do that to coordinate a system.
Wow, it's a huge scope of responsibility. So thank you for your public service and your leadership. And in addition to your role as commissioner, you also have the honor of serving as the past chair and current member of the State Higher Education Executive Officers, known as SHEO. So can you briefly describe SHEO and what does that national perspective bring to your work here in Indiana?
think it's always important when you engage in national work that you make sure that it has practical applicability to the state in which you reside. So we've been very engaged with SHEO. As a part of our responsibility at the Commission, we are very committed to using data to drive reports that actually we think will help and inform the work that's done at the colleges and universities. SHEO helps us do that because they look at emerging trends, financial work, and we can compare ourselves to how we're doing in other states. I think that's very important. There are also four higher education compacts, of which the Midwestern Higher Education Compact is one of those, and we work very closely with that organization as well. Both are member organizations that I think Indiana has very great benefit from being involved with, especially in the understanding of financial work and policy work.
Terrific. Well, thanks for your service there as well. So my final question for you is, the Commission recently updated its strategic plan, and you came up with goals for the next 3 to 5 years. In a nutshell, can you tell us what are your priorities, and what does the audience here today need to know about higher education in Indiana?
Well, the first thing to know is that higher education is changing so dramatically and so quickly that a strategic plan has a very short shelf life. I have to call out my predecessor, Stan Jones, who really began the strategic planning process in 2008 while he was still at the Commission. And Indiana has been a leader in strategic planning for higher education. Prior to 2008, with the first strategic plan, each of our colleges and universities would have a strategic plan, but we didn't look at this at a statewide level. And it became very clear that as you were looking at scarce resources, policies that impacted across the institutions, that we needed to look at this in a strategic way. Our most recent plan was approved last year, and it really speaks to what we're talking about today. It's called Reaching Higher, Delivering Value. And when we talk about value, we're talking about everything from quality to affordability to all the ways in which you measure the value of a higher education experience. We have three guiding principles, and that is to develop a student-centered, that's our first principle, mission-driven, acknowledging the missions of our colleges and universities, and what was, at that point, somewhat controversial, workforce-aligned system of higher education. That's certainly the subject of the day as we talk about aligning what people learn with what they do. We're focused on getting more students to complete, and whenever possible, to do so in a more timely way, making sure that we measure what students are learning with new providers in ways that we talk about competency, and then making sure that what they learn is aligned to what they're going to do in their career.
Well, that's perfect context for our panel discussion, the topic of which is the value of higher education in a 21st century. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Teresa and our three panelists.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. In keeping with our topic, talking about the value of higher education in the 21st century, I think it's important to first of all note that Indiana has established a goal that 60% of Hoosiers would have a quality degree or credential beyond high school. To put that in some perspective, we're at 42% now. We're moving in the right direction, but I think we need to move faster with a greater sense of urgency. And so that brings us to talk about value and what it actually means. And most of us would agree that education beyond high school is more important than ever. We know that incomes are higher, unemployment rates lower, health better, civic participation greater. All the ways in which we would measure value seem obvious that higher education has a value. But isn't it interesting that more than ever we have people talking about, is college worth it? And what is the value of higher education in the 21st century? Many of these discussions are led because of the cost of college or student debt or people being gainfully employed after they graduate from college. So let's begin to unpack those issues a little bit with each of you as you share your thoughts about challenges in higher education generally, and then more specifically, how you see the challenges and opportunities at your particular institutions and how you are providing those services to the students that you serve. We're going to start with President Danko, and then we'll go to President Elsner, and then we'll go to President Manuel next.
Good. Well, thank you. Appreciate being here today. This whole issue of the value of education has been so pervasive. There's so many things to it, and a lot of credible reasons that is the case, whether it's the rising cost of tuition, The changing demographics that are out there today have become a challenge for us as well. We really are quite attuned to the way technology has changed transfer of knowledge, which really underpins a lot of things that we look at Butler in terms of how are we changing our programs, our approach to education. And just like technology has affected and disrupted so many other sectors, we're not immune to it. And I think that's one of the reasons people question. You know, I could go online and learn X. You know, do I need a degree for that? Jobs that are out there, companies looking for individuals are very skill-oriented. You know, they're looking for computer science students, for example. So that also kind of raises some of the tension around the value of an education. And it is something that places like Butler and the other private institutions as well have to take seriously, right? The cost of education is a major issue. Butler, as a result, ends up giving close to $70 million a year in financial aid to make sure students are able to afford the education that they have. So from a macro level, there's a lot of technological, economic forces that are raising some of the issues that you mentioned and putting pressure on us to respond accordingly.
So, President Elsner, as you look at the services provided at Marion University, I mean, are you hearing that? Are students or parents or employers questioning the value of the education, either higher education generally or more specifically at your school?
In the press, you'll hear that. But actually, it's a great time to be in our sector. I mean, it's never been more valuable in a highly technical world where you need great leaders and people with some standard of execution and excellence and character, we're right in the right spot. I do think, matter of fact, Dr. Marisotis is here, the inside cover of his magazine, you call it Focus, wrote about outcomes and competency-based education. I think a lot of what we have to do is make sure that we redesign the education to meet the students where we have today. It's a very different deal where used to be you had a captive audience, you had these 50, 100 really smart guys, we call them professors at our place. And then there are captive audience, they come in and they start talking, and then they learn and they take a test. That model will not work with this generation. And you mentioned in your article, Jamie, about especially low-income disadvantaged students, it has to be very practical. You have to say, this is where you're going, help them see a trajectory, design a curriculum, co-curricular, and external institution program where students are engaged in learning and feel like, hey, I know where this is leading. It's got to be a different enterprise, and it's exciting because with technology, frankly, you can do it. Financial aid, we're always raising money for that. See me afterwards if you want to sponsor a student. But it's constant. The demographics of the students we're serving undergraduate, walking through the door, it's nothing like you folks saw, which is great, by the way. But there are some funding challenges there, and you need capital to change. As a matter of fact, that was in an article. It's expensive to redesign. My provost is here. We often say change the people or change the people, don't we, Dr. Anneking? So we've got to watch what we're giving students, and then the value shoots right through the roof. Changes lives, and it changes their families' lives.
So in particular at Marion, you also serve an adult population, and you've done a lot to talk about the achievement gap. And do you find that this is part of the reason why we're questioning more, that you have adults who come back who don't have the skills they need for the workforce?
Well, a big part of our moves, frankly, people with degrees that aren't in as productive places they want to be. Our second degree nursing program, take that for example. A lot online. We partner with St. Vincent Hospital, St. Vincent Health, Ascension Health, actually around the country. We teach students today right now in Nashville, Tennessee, about 70 of them, in a partnership program. So adults, to become highly productive, earn a wage, take care of themselves and their family, we've got to be in the game. We are not in a Carnegie credit, get a diploma institution. We're a learning enterprise. And we like to think, frankly, we're in the high schools, and we like to think way into the later stage of life where we can be part of your continuous learning.
President Manuel, you've been in higher education for a while and have seen a lot of these changes, things come and go. You've providing, University of Indianapolis is growing and thriving. What do you think about the challenges that are facing higher education and what's the landscape for the University of Indianapolis?
Thanks. So first, I've got to put into my rider that I don't go third. less to talk about as we go.
You'll go first next.
Thank you. But what I see, or what I think I'm dealing with, are really two main issues in higher ed. One is the commodification of it. So pushing it into being cheaper and faster and not understanding that it's a learning enterprise and that it's more like a service industry than it is a commodity. And while the goals are great to find the number of people to get the degree that we need in order to do it, you have to have a long-term view of what that does to the economic vitality and the quality of life of the people that experience it. So at UIndy, as an example, we serve almost 50% first-generation college students. And I'm happy to say that the institutional effect that we have on those students is such that they will attain both aspirations and realities that they could never have had otherwise. And we do that on an average debt of $28,000, $29,000 a year, which is less than any car anybody's gonna buy over time. And that investment itself, I'm an unabashed supporter of the fact that if we do this right, like our institutions are doing in Indiana, and we partner with the government and the policy right, which we're doing right in Indiana, you can accommodate the decommodification of higher education to the benefit of the economic development and the quality of life of the individuals who live there. The second big issue I see is that we don't live in the both and, we live in the either or. And so when we say college has high debt, what we really mean to say is that there are portions of college sector that have really high debts, and there are portions of the college sector that have really high default rates. But when you look at the majority of the institutions, we are doing really terrific work with the populations that are coming through. And while I want to help with the goal of getting us to the 60%, I don't want to change the learning environment that our students are in or make that somehow more efficient only because the goal is more. And so the really vibrant communities around that produce economic vitality for all, think the Route 128 around Boston or DC or Raleigh-Durham or lots of places around, what they value is the fact that there is a pipeline of institutions that continually hand people from one place to another, to another, to another, instead of trying to all become the same thing. And I think that's happening in Indiana. And so to me, it's not a question of are we in a bubble and are we going to burst, but we have a real moment in higher education to design ourselves, and not just individually. So Jim has a vision 2020. I have a vision 2030.
Ours is 2025.
2025.
We're always, you live with a lot of hope to the 30s.
That's right.
Most presidents don't last that long.
What I will say is when I presented that to my board, one of them said, there is a fine line between a vision and a hallucination. But what I'll say is that those visions are internal. They focus on the schools themselves. And as a region, if we begin to focus together, there's a handoff that happens that benefits the larger community. I think that's the design question that we want to get.
I think one other thing I would point out here on this whole issue of the value of education, our ROI on the tuition dollars, right here on this very stage, I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago, David Linhart from the New York Times shared a lot of factual information on the value of the degree and how that plays out in people's careers and in their long-term earning potential. So there's a lot of hearsay in these things that are happening as change is so dominant. So we really do have to step back. There's a lot of factual information out there that would support the value of an education at a private school. David did a particularly good job of that. So.
Well, I certainly don't disagree about the value of higher education, but I think all of us would agree that we need to be committed to making sure that we create even greater value and that we have all of our stakeholder groups who believe that's taking place. Not only is it debt and affordability that we talk about, but people talk about, will they leave equipped to do a job in the 21st century? And this idea of going to school and then getting a job and there being a disconnect between the two is unacceptable, I think, to the students or to the employers. So I'm going to start with you this time, since you were last time. And have you share a few thoughts about what is the responsibility? Do you have a responsibility to not only educate students, but help them get jobs? And if so, how are you doing that? And what is the alignment between what students learn and what they do in life?
Yeah. So this is the piece of the puzzle that I can't define as well as I'd like to. we're both, higher education is both the problem and the solution at the same time. And I don't think there's granularity in the conversation to really understand how. And that's why I said, if we get together, there are pieces of my institution that can help solve that problem, but I can't solve the entire problem of it. And so when I look at the Indiana Business came out with a survey about what the CEOs wanted in employees, it was logical thinking and reasoning and writing and communication skills and work ethic. Those aren't skill sets. Those are, well, I mean, they're skill sets, but they're not things that you can show competency in unless you're in a learning environment, try to teach it, and then you practice that. And that takes time. It takes time to move through. And my organization is a comprehensive liberal arts institution, which means we teach that and we let them apply it to a position or a job, and they move through that pipeline, hopefully seamlessly. In the end, I feel like my job and the job of the faculty and the schools we have is to prepare them for that immediate job when they get out and a career over time. And to do that is both and. It requires that they have the internships and the opportunities. And more so, we're looking now towards generating social capital for them, not just a resume and experiences, but helping our students understand how important it is to come to an event like this to develop your social capital so that you can show people and work with people to create the job and the experiences that you want, and then give them the skills that last a lifetime. And I think economically, if we simply produce people that have a skill for now, you end up mortgaging the future of the economic productivity and the quality of life of people.
Well, that's the same issue, you know, we've talked about on Wall Street. Bottom line focus, immediate results, what are the returns this particular quarter? It's a longer term game. Right? I mean, we do have to worry about immediately placing our students, but we also have to worry about the fact that they're going to change careers and jobs multiple times. So, as Rob mentioned, when we talk even about the value of the liberal arts education, the creativity, the problem-solving skills, the ability to adapt, so as things change in the future, which they will, you've got to prepare them both to kind of get that launched position, the first one, but also how they're going to adapt and change moving forward. There's as many articles out there, to Rob's point, about the ability to be flexible, analytical, creative, as there are about those immediate skills. I've been in a position too, both at Butler and elsewhere, where the same things are thrown at me. They're not asking me for one more accounting class or one more, communications class in X. They're looking for this broader set of skills and make sure that those students are able to adapt and change. So
President Elster, if that's true, and the value of the liberal arts, especially as it is aligned with technical skills and applied knowledge as well, why do we have the disconnect when Gallup surveys, for example, between whether employers think that people are prepared for the job and whether faculty believe people are prepared for the job? Because there is a huge divide between those two.
Well, in my earlier comments, I talk about redesigning. Higher ed cannot be in a bubble or in a castle or ivy tower. We have to design outcomes. I'm quoting your article a lot. I hope you pay me later, Jamie. But Jamie talked about every course, frankly, you should be able to measure knowledge, what you learned, or what you can do. The issue on the table, in addition to that, where I would have added to your article, but you didn't ask for input, the what are you going to be? You know, as a Catholic university, we spend a lot of time talking about faith, values, trustworthiness, character. And by the way, those aren't impossible to measure. They're a little more difficult. But at the end of the education, and when you start responding to a poll, what'd you think of your education? How did it affect you? And how our institutions are responsible to students, but we're responsible to you, the common good. I mean, who's going to lead our businesses and our schools and our healthcare? What kind of people are they going to be? We talked to 1,000 people when we developed our vision about educating transformational leaders. We were real concerned. Every website, everywhere says they educate leaders. What is it in substance? 1,000 people took notes, smart, inquisitive people, skilled people. Then they really wanted to talk. Trustworthiness, character. Fourth thing, healthy. Spiritually, emotionally, physically healthy people endure, can go the long distance. So in a university campus, sure, we teach courses, But we have athletic programs, student government, speech teams. They learn so much in co-curricular. We send people abroad all over the world. We send them out in this community. We send them throughout the state. All those experiences are part of the value of a degree. We have to articulate it better, and we have to measure it better. But I kid you, everybody in here knows this. Jeff Simoleon talked, and actually Clay Robbins, Jeff Simoleon, your presentation today were about values. Jeff said, we hire interview people. They're smart, and then they go, they don't have a heart. They don't have enough heart. We educate hearts. We educate much more than someone that can pass a physics test. We appreciate that. And Dr. Sefcik, when they come out of the medical school, we like them to be able to give, you know, basic skills are pretty important when we go in there to, you know, stay alive. How do they treat us as a human being? How are they with culture? How are they with communication? We have larger purposes that aren't always easy to measure, but they're core to what we do every day, and frankly, so much a part of our mission that a lot of superficial commentators, et cetera, aren't able to even wrap their arms around it.
Well, you talk about measuring what people know, and let's talk about the things that, some of the things you've talked about are difficult to measure. But we have this whole movement now, which is called competency-based education, which basically upends much about the 2- and 4-year model in terms of time or structure, and says that it isn't the time that a student spends in a seat that matters, but it's what they know and learn and are able to show what they know. And so you have lots of conversations going on right now. It's one of the three sections of our strategic plan. We have all kinds of new providers. We have, and I guess my question to you would be, you know, is this just the latest fad of the day, or is this really going to revolutionize the way people learn and be able to show what they know?
I just say very succinctly, every course is competency-based. If there aren't clear outcomes and measurable, we shouldn't be putting resource in it. But in addition to knowing things and doing things, what kind of a person are you going to be is additionally part of it. The other thing I like about competency-based, it's more than theory, it attaches the learning enterprise to the world. In other words, if you have outcomes that won't matter, the provost and I would say, well, maybe we ought to not teach that course.
But it also measures that the student is in control in terms of when the student
right.
shows that they've mastered it, and that could be 3 years, or, you know, you've seen a lot of reinventing of the
Absolutely.
Bachelor degree, and so the unit of time is when the student shows that they have learned, as opposed to the traditional credit hour.
But, you know, I do, this form of competency-based education has been going, there's been variations of this going back 30, 40 years. I'm not so sure it's necessarily new. Maybe it's getting more attention. My concern is that as you look at ways of measuring progress, and there's a lot of different ways to do that, this is a great way in the current reality, right? Because now with technology, it is possible to learn something in a different period of time. We don't have to be locked into 14 weeks or locked into 1 year or whatever it might be. So, but my concern is there's got to be adaptability of these systems of education and learning for different realities and different individuals. Some people are going to learn faster than others. So a competency base, if you have that skill in a particular area, it could make a lot of sense. Some of the things that Dan and Rob and myself talk about in terms of kind of the whole person, mind, body, heart, and soul, that might happen over years. So that time framework, as we think about undergrad residential, typically is four years. We probably have to change the mix in there. We don't have to be so locked into like X number of weeks, but we want to think about the mix of the things that we have in there that develop the skills they need for a current reality and for future reality, right? So I actually think it's a good model. There's a lot of good models. We don't want to get beholden to any one that we think is the perfect solution. And I think there's a little bit of an ROI push on competency-based and some of these other measures. And again, we have to just kind of look at them in the whole. Right?
One of the things, and most of you in the audience probably know this, but one of the ways that we're trying to talk about this is through this thing called prior learning assessments, where people are able to show what they know. We've been especially successful with this with people who return from the military, who've gained skills and knowledge and education, and then how we actually can measure that and align it when they go back to their schooling. So we're not asking them to learn again what they already know. And I know that here we have people who tend to serve a lot of undergraduate. Dan, you serve a lot of older adults as well. But you know, if we're going to get to our big goal in Indiana, which is in and of itself, it's not that the 60% is important. It's that that's what the workforce is going to need, people who have these skills. And so we need to bring the adults back as well. And I think we've been especially attuned to using the experiences of adults through competency-based education, not treating a 30 or 35-year-old as if they've learned nothing in their life. And then how do we measure that? I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I was kind of hoping we were going to run out of time. But what I'll say is that over 25 years in higher education, I'm sick of chasing the shiny object. And these things have come at us as disruptors for years and years and years, and they're functional, meaning they come about because higher education has abrogated its right and responsibility to change and be flexible and connect to the place where we're putting our students. But we're putting our students in jobs and in communities, in churches, in nonprofits, and so there's a whole host of different ways to judge competency. And I'm with you. Somebody coming back from a service or having worked for a while, you can judge a competency pretty easily. The 900 adult students that we have at the University of Indianapolis, we have programs for them to do that. But it's very hard to take an 18-year-old and say, because you went to 2 weeks in Habitat for Humanity, you're now competent in logistics. And so the both-and scenario is something that's very important. Just by a quick show of hands, if I could educate somebody by 19 and give them the credential and said that they were competent in those things, how many of you would hire that 19-year-old to do the bachelor's required job?
It kind of depends.
I'll meet you.
I got to have to check out the job.
That is the solution is both-and. And so the University of Indianapolis and Butler and Marion doing what it does next to IUPUI, great school, Nasser, I told you, I'd give you the plug.
Thank you.
Doing that next to Ivy Tech, doing that with the workforce development and the liberal arts and the professional is what will get you to that 60 goal. And finding a ways to incentivize the market to show what's good inside of higher education is, I think, what pushes us forward into that.
The collaboration is so important too, and these conversations, you know, the chance for presidents to get together, but looking at different opportunities for us to work with IUPUI, with Ivy Tech, with any other institution. But your point is well taken. I agree that if somebody's an adult learner, it's a different situation than an 18-year-old. I really believe that there's a lot of value in this rising generation having the opportunity to kind of leave home for a period of time, to live and learn with each other, to socialize, to develop certain skills, in addition to those that could probably be measured in a more competency-based way.
So. We also do talk about competency, though, in terms of learning outcomes for undergraduates, like the 30-credit-hour general education core, where we have that's based on learning outcomes. One could say that's competency. So I think that does have pertinence to an 18 to 22-year-old as well in terms of how you come up with learning outcomes that are aligned with their degrees or programs.
Yeah, that's a point I was trying to – one of the points I want to make is that if you teach a course, you ought to have a clear understanding of outcomes, the degree qualification project we participated in. Every step along the way, curricular, co-curricular, and learning experiences outside of campus should move towards a vision of what an educated person from your institution looks like. And this builds. And it can be measured. And some students will be particularly good in other areas and just excel off the charts. In other places, they might hit minimal competency where you say they can graduate. But it's a point of being very clear. One of the things that maybe higher ed fell into, we teach the courses, we design them according to our needs and what we think's important. And when they've graduated, of course, what we think's important, we'll give them a degree, and then you'll think it's important. That isn't going to work. We're going to have to be very connected with all sorts of forces in the economy so people can grow and move. And frankly, I must say, in this city, all institutions, if you look around the country, places, the world, every place that's thriving, human flourishing is advancing, there are great institutions of higher learning, plural. They're well-funded, They are a magnet for talent. They engage with the community. We had a speaker here a couple, three times ago. GDP rises, productivity rises, which means wages will rise. And the opportunity gap between those at the top end of the socioeconomic ladder and the bottom closes with education. We have a very diverse campus at my place. I see an awful lot of Pell Grant students. You mentioned it. It's hard not to cry on graduation day when you know so many of the students and where they came from. And you know that as a result, they're in med school and they're going into businesses and they're taking over classrooms. And what the multiple on a graduate with the right kind of values and education, and then the families they'll form and their children, the multiple, the return on investment in higher ed is hard to equate, which is kind of makes the conversation a little interesting. People wondering about the value of higher education. I could deluge you with statistics, and we probably need to be better communicators collectively and nationally, but a commencement day, it's hard to keep a dry eye when you know you changed the trajectory of so many people. And very talented student, you give them a larger purpose in life, and you connected them with the world, and you're advancing the common good. So in terms of what we do together and the big goal that Luminous put out, all hands on deck because it changes everything. And we have the institutions here in this community to do it.
Well, you know, as you're talking about these things, I'm reminded of the Gallup-Purdue poll, which the commission helped fund and it partnered with the private colleges and universities in the area. The reason I mention it is because Butler did really good in it. But it was a very credible, I think there were something like 75,000 alums from different institutions across the state and across the country, going back from graduates in the 1950s to forward, across many dimensions in terms of the impact of their education, their careers, their life, their happiness. And it really was an extraordinary poll and very effective in terms of kind of measuring that long-term success. We were pleased again. We did quite well in exceeding Indiana universities, our aspirant universities, and the averages. And so that gave us a lot of confidence in terms of the impact of our education on changing and transforming lives into successful individuals.
So. I think that's very important. This return on investment concept is both a qualitative and a quantitative story, and you have to be able to measure both and HEART, which we've really tried to do with the Indiana College Value Index and show that, because we have to do that. We have to show our value in ways that people really understand. We can't assume that they know that in spite of all the good reasons why we know higher education is important. I'd like to shift just for our final time together to talk about a topic that you've all three hit on a little bit, but more specifically, and that is the changing nature of the world of work and what is the responsibility of higher education to the individual, to the employer, to the state, to provide help with their immediate, we hear about the skills gap all the time. There is this disconnect between what the jobs that we have out there and the skills that people have to fill those jobs. I mean, like many in the room here, I grew up in a time in which education beyond high school was not critically important. In fact, an eighth grade education provided the middle class life for many Hoosiers for a long time. And the whole world shifted. And I'm informed by that personal experience as I think about the fact that the world is shifting again. And are we really preparing people for this next way? And what is our obligation for lifelong learning, for saying, we're going to help you get that first certificate? And it's going to be a great way to start. There's a very strong likelihood that you will need to be revisiting that. On this other side, you have all of the issues related to automation and artificial intelligence and the number of jobs that are going to be replaced, the number of jobs that we don't even know what their names are right now. So in the spirit of gaining greater productivity, I do actually believe jobs are being created. But it comes with it an obligation to teach and educate and train people in a very different way. What are you doing in this place to actually talk about not just what they graduate with, but the need to be educated throughout their life to meet the changing needs?
Well, the whole, as you said, you can't predict what some of these jobs are going to be. So I come back again to the point of making sure you have students that are educated to be flexible, to be problem solvers, to adapt, and you do have to continue to educate, be educated during your life. We need to provide that education. So it's not going to just happen in a four-year span. They might need to come back later in time for another form of education. So our obligation is something that we work on quite aggressively and seriously, is to work with corporations out there, organizations, to do a bit of cooperative education. So I would contend that our internship programs, our hands-on education, connecting theory with practice, which we do across our university, we all do that, are working even with thinking in the region in a larger way. What type of technologies are we trying to attract to this area? So how could we work cooperatively across the city, the state, to make sure that the types of jobs that we want in the state are there? It's part of our obligation. So our job is not to look in isolation at a four-year program, but to look at a holistic way in terms of how we're preparing our students for the types of jobs that we want and we're attracting into this region, and to make sure that we're really pushing on areas like innovation, technology, and assure that we have the sectors and the talent here that's going to fill those jobs in the future.
So I think our job is to shed the hubris of higher education and assume that we know what we do in the context that we do it, and then we hand off and move on. And so what's been said tonight is good for me to hear, because it's happening at all of our institutions. We will forever hold close to our heart the liberal arts, the faith tradition, the service mentality that we build in all of the students that come, whether they're adult or non-credit or undergraduate. They'll always be the center. And then our job is to innovate the professional side of that to build off of it. So just recently we launched the RBNS Engineering School, which is an attempt to educate people to move into the STEM field. And inside of that, the connector between liberal arts and engineering is a creative design spine, which teaches people how to think and reason through problems that they don't have any reason to be reasoning through. And that helps them manage the changing tides that are out there. In about a month's time, we'll launch something called the Metropolitan College, which is our opportunity to open up all of the developments that we have and the expertise that we have at the university and connect it to places inside the city that are doing workforce development, like Jason Cloth and Ascend, which is working out of CICP, to connect the business needs to the abilities, the design and delivery abilities of the educational institutions. And you see that happening in Indianapolis, going all the way back to the 70s when Gypsy was formed and all that happened. It's in the DNA of this community, and I think we just need to rev it up a little bit more, shed the barriers that prevent education from connecting, and then make those things more relevant as we go through.
Some final thoughts about lifelong learning and your obligation to help the graduates and those who come back.
Some has been said, it's hubris, and it's also a cadence of habit. You think of credits, degrees, gone. Thomas Jefferson, a long time ago, talked about a University of Virginia being an academical community that would be more womb to tomb, that once you attract a student, they're part of you for life, or other connecting to Clips College, where we did a whole new thing with our Educators College. There's going to be a consulting arm that partners with schools to actually advance reading and advance science. So I think we have to be much more interactive with the world, design learning experiences for people in business and in the professions, physicians, if they want to. We have a medical school. Does that stop when you walk across the stage, or do we stay in the game? So higher ed, as at least what we're doing and working hard at it, to stay in the game forever, frankly. And in that regard, you stop not only thinking of credits and degrees, you start of connecting with the world in various ways, in very practical ways, which, by the way, is terribly informative to our professors and people who work inside the academy daily. Once you connect with the world, it kind of changes what you teach and how you teach. And so we think it's very important to think not of degrees as stopping points, but we'll keep on going with various industries and new movements and technology. I see Claire coming, so I'm done.
Well, I don't know about you, but I feel much better about the future of higher education because of these three. Yeah.
You've been listening to a panel discussion from the Economic Club, part of the 2017-2018 Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series. Join us next month at this time for the Chairman, President, and CEO of Duke Energy, Lynn Good. You can find more information at economicclubofindiana.com. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Media in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.